This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Friday, January 17th, 2014. I'm Caleb Brown. It's fair to say that the three previous occupants of the White House had better records than Barack Obama on trade, but that doesn't mean a good trade agenda in 2014 is dead. Daniel Eikenson, director of the Trade Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, explains.
Under the George H.W. Bush administration, the Uruguay round was advanced almost to its conclusion. That produced the World Trade Organization. It was the last completed multilateral trade round that we've had. Bill Clinton was there to see it through the URAA, the Uruguay round agreement, as was he facilitated the conclusion of the NAFTA. And, you know, he tried to get trade promotion authority reinstated for himself, and he was outward looking. But he was denied fast track at the end of his tenure, primarily because Democrats did not want to give that to him. George W. Bush came into office and launched the Doha Round in November 2001. He completed about a dozen trade agreements, mostly with smaller countries. But when he left office, there were three agreements that he had completed that never passed Congress, one with Colombia, Korea, and Panama. And when the Democrats took control of Congress in January 2007, with 2 years remaining in Bush's term, they basically said, no more. We are shifting our emphasis from liberalization to enforcement, and we are not going to even see these through. And in fact, President Bush, George W. Bush, submitted the Colombia agreement to Congress, and according to the Trade Promotion Authority legislation, they were supposed to consider it. And vote on it within 90 days, but Nancy Pelosi, Speaker of the House at the time, decided to change the rules retroactively, and they did not consider the agreement. So one of the things that's going on now is Trade Promotion Authority has the legislation to restore it for President Obama has been introduced, but it gets a lot more credit for sort of insulating trade agreements from tinkering from Congress and commits Congress to do certain things. But that's not really true. Congress can really ultimately do whatever it wants, and it has breached these agreements in the past.
And President Obama has imposed some trade restrictions that he felt were necessary but probably sour relationships with other countries.
Yeah. You know, he came into office when he campaigned. He said, I'm not sure about these trade agreements and what they've done for our economy. And, you know, if I'm elected, one of the first things I'm going to do in office is to reopen the NAFTA. Well, shortly after taking office, he called the president of Mexico and prime minister of Canada and effectively said, you know, just kidding. Don't worry about that. But he didn't really lift a finger to get those pending three bilaterals through the Congress. He basically capitulated to the mood that was set by Senator Reid and Representative Pelosi. But after the midterm election in 2010, where the Democrats took a bit of a shellacking, as he put it, he went to the business community and said, okay, I'm going to help you get these agreements through. And sure enough, in 2011, those three bilaterals did become ratified. And beginning around that time, the administration was pursuing this Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiation with, at the time, which was about – there were about six countries. Since then, other countries have joined, and it's now 12 countries, if you include the United States. And allegedly, they are near the conclusion of that negotiation. But I think there's a lot of meat left on that bone, and I think we've seen some – interest in moving the trade agenda forward. Just last week, the Trade Promotion Authority legislation was introduced by the chairman and ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee and by the chairman of the House Ways and Means Committee. Conspicuously absent from sponsorship was Sandra Levin, the ranking member on Ways and Means. He is unhappy with the idea of restoring Trade Promotion Authority. In fact, he's unhappy of any trade legislation that would liberalize trade or that is not sufficiently deferential to the interests of Detroit, the Detroit automakers.
So here we are, 2014. What should free traders be hoping for, looking for, expecting?
Well, you know, free traders have to settle more or less. I mean, those of us who are interested in free trade would take a different tack than what is taken. You know, we should be supportive of these free trade agreements, even though the benefits to consumers and taxpayers are achieved sort of residually, sort of the crumbs of a big cake. I mean, these trade agreements are all about advancing the interests of U.S. producers and balancing those interests against NGOs, against labor unions' interests and environmentalists. Consumer interests aren't really well represented. And, you know, if you really believe in free trade, consumers and taxpayers are the real beneficiaries. And we don't need to engage in these negotiations at all. We can just say, you know what, we're going to get rid of these tariffs. We're going to get rid of these stifling regulations. But instead, we play this game where we pretend our barriers are negotiating chits, that they're assets that we love and we want to hold on to. Maybe it would be hard for you to infer from that comment that I actually do support the effort for the TPP. But I do because it does grant greater economic liberties at the margin. I think we can support that and at the same time try to advance the cause of autonomous unilateral trade liberalization and make Americans more aware of the fact that they benefit from access to imports.
One of the most free trade organizations, I was happy to learn, is the Consumer Electronics Association here. And it's not surprising why. They have parts and components that come from all over the world. They move all over the world. And then those final products then move all over the world.
That's right. Something like 80% or over 80% of global trade is in intermediate goods. If you impose duties or you frustrate the supply chains of these components coming into your economy, you are raising the cost of production for your own assemblers, producers, engineers, and exporters. So there really is a premium to be placed on openness and frictionlessness in these supply chains. You know, we had the Great Recession a few years ago, and lots of experts were talking about the need to avoid protectionism, and the G20 countries were reassuring one another that they would not engage in this tit-for-tat 1930s-style protectionism. But the fact is there was a lot of natural pressure on governments from within to remain open because so many businesses are reliant upon imported intermediate goods and raw materials. And really that obviates to me the sort of absurdity of having trade agreements. We already have interests that are telling governments to remain open if you want us to be competitive. Why do we need to get this in writing? There is an argument that it would prevent backsliding if subsequent governments to come in and there's a populist who wants to make overtures to particular constituents. So that holds some water. But the fact is we have not liberalized very much while these negotiations have been going on. You know, had the Doha round, which was the last multilateral round launched in 2001, which is now incomplete and possibly off track for good, had that been declared dead, or if it becomes declared dead, I think that would give more motivation to governments to say, you know what, let's stop treating our trade barriers as negotiating chits. Let's view them as reforms, and let's make those reforms.
Is unilateral disarmament, for lack of a better term, with respect to trade, is that going to be on the table even in some narrow part of the economy?
Yeah, you know, it is. Unfortunately, it is called unilateral disarmament
which is fine. It's fine. I like that term.
Except it's the wrong metaphor. You know, this is not a war. It's not a. Trade is subjected to these sports metaphors, like it's us against them, our team against their team, and exports are our points and imports are the other team's points. And that it's the wrong way to think about it.
Because let's call it enhanced cooperation, something like that.
Yeah. Well, look, there has been unilateral liberalization in various in small increments in the United States. We have something called the Miscellaneous Tariff Bill, which every Congress has passed except the last one. The last one fell victim to an internal battle among the Republican Party about whether or not suspending duties on particular products constitutes an earmark. And that battle basically sidetracked the miscellaneous tariff bill, which would remove duties on intermediate goods under these conditions. There can't be domestic production, and eliminating the duties can't amount to more than, I think, a $500,000 deprivation of customs revenues. So very tight terms. But the concept could be graduated if we recognize that almost 70% of the value of U.S. imports are intermediate goods, and that when we have taxes on them, we are raising the cost of production for U.S. businesses and making them less competitive. Once that sinks in, and once the business makes a compelling case, I think we could be on a different trajectory toward more true trade liberalization, toward unilateral trade liberalization.
Dan Eikenson is Director of Trade Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. You can read more of his work at cato.org.